The Tom Woods Show, episode 516.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
There's an exciting event going on in Toronto, November 6th to 7th, 2015. It's Mises Canada's fourth international conference of prices and markets. And you can get in for one-third off because you listen to this show. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Canada. Friends, if you're planning to buy gold, make sure you don't get ripped off. There are a lot of scams out there. So read Peter Schiff's report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off. You can read it for free through tomwoods.com/scams. Welcome to another episode of The Tom Woods Show. I'm so glad to welcome back to the show Bob Murphy. Robert P. Murphy has not joined us in quite some time. Bob and I have been busy on another project, of course, Contra Krugman, our weekly podcast refuting Paul Krugman. Please check that out at ContraKrugman.com. But this episode reminds us that Bob will still be a fixture here at The Tom Woods Show. And it's so wonderful to be able to feature him today because of this fantastic new project. He's just released a book with a medical doctor, Doug McGuff, and the book is called The Primal Prescription, Surviving the Sick Care Sinkhole. There is not a really good book on healthcare from a libertarian perspective. There isn't. I mean, you can name me a few, but they're not that good, frankly. They're just not that good. This is the one you've been waiting for. This is an issue that our critics throw at us all the time. And a lot of times our answers are kind of lame, frankly. Not anymore. Not anymore. You are going to want to read The Primal Prescription. And more than that, you're going to want to hear Bob Murphy talk to you about it. Most of you by this point know all about Bob Murphy. He holds a PhD in economics from New York University. He's the author of many books at this point. He's the author of, for instance, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the New Deal. Those two books are available on audiobook, by the way, and you can get one of them for free at tomwoodsaudio.com. Bob is the author of study guides to the major Austrian economics treatises like Human Action and Man, Economy, and State, and he blogs over at consultingbyrpm.com. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Long time no talk here on the show. Of course, I talk to you constantly in other ways, certainly with Contra Krugman. We got a good episode coming up later this week. That's bluster because we haven't done the episode and maybe it stinks, but after five episodes, I feel like I can just say without any hint of bravado that it's going to be a good episode on Denmark and why it stinks and we don't want to live in Denmark. It's going to be a little more subtle than that, probably.
Well, you and I are the two people on the planet with the most experience doing Contra Krugman, so if anybody's going to make a great episode, it'll be us.
And, of course, if there's anybody who's an expert on Denmark, I would say Murphy and Woods, right?
Yeah, it's my top two choices.
All right, let's talk about something that you are an expert on. See, I've gotten really, really good at awkward transitions, and that one was pretty good, actually, I think. Let's talk about this brand-new book you have. I just told people about it. The Primal Prescription, tremendous. I am so thrilled about this book. We've needed this book for a long time. Our side of things does not have a particularly good book on healthcare, if you ask me. But we have some wonkish books out there. At the time of Obamacare, I can't think of her name now. There's a woman who, Sally Pipes, maybe, came out with a book, The Case Against Obamacare. And I read it because I was looking for nuggets for rollback, and I was just totally underwhelmed by it. And then this book, The Primal Prescription, hit me like a thunderbolt when I saw it. The material that's covered in here and the success that you've had in bringing to bear a lot of material that would have been impossible to do without the assistance of a medical doctor, and he couldn't have done without the assistance of an economist, the package is absolutely tremendous. So I have a lot of questions I want to ask you about it, but I want you to try to make the case. This is probably your first interview on this. This is the release date of the book, October 21st, 2015. So I want to get you primed and ready for when other media outlets talk to you. How would you make your pitch as to why this book is unique and great?
Well, as you say, thank you very much, Tom, for those kind words. And yes, I wanted to come to you and have this be the first interview I do for the book, also because Rachel Maddow said no. But okay. Yes,
I'm always coming in second to her.
No, but seriously, thank you for the kind words, Tom. And yes, what let me just tell a little bit about where this came from is that Mark Sisson approached me to help write this book, and he had an earlier manuscript from Doug McDuff, my co-author, the ER doctor, and he knew it needed, you know, some the economic element, and so we sort of joined forces and worked on this. And then, as you say, I brought the economics to the table, and Doug has the experience. But I don't want to downplay Doug's own knowledge of free market economics. I mean, he already understood, you know, he was a fan of Milton Friedman and others, and he certainly, you know, Thomas Sowell. And so it was really just an incredible thing to find this guy that, wow, there's this ER doctor out there who wants to write a book critiquing, and I want to clarify too, is this isn't just a critique of Obamacare. This is really just showing what the whole history of U.S. medicine and how, as you know, it was not, oh, the free market was tried and failed. We just document in the beginning, going through from the beginning, showing how each intervention led to further interventions. So I, of course, knew coming to the project that that was probably going to be the pattern I would find, but just to fill it in with the details, it was really refreshing to see that, oh, yes, you know, these views that we have really do apply to this case, and you do not have to fear critics who say, oh, yeah, the free market economics, that works for computers perhaps or televisions, but no, when it comes to medicine, it's totally different. It's on the contrary. It's just almost eerie how much standard free market economic reasoning shows interventions in healthcare leading to further ones. So in this book, the beginning, we go give a history of the government intervention in healthcare and how did we get to where we were on the eve of the Affordable Care Act, or what's called Obamacare. Then we go through, and I walk through several CBO reports and so forth to show what I think are some shocking statistics about Obamacare, internal government analyses, just to show the public that the story they were getting from the administration was not at all what internally they knew to be the case. But then that's not where we stop. We then go and say, how do you, the reader, do something about this? How do you take charge of your own health? And this is where Doug just really shines. He gave, you know, his experience being an ER doctor, working with patients and seeing how screwed up the system is, he gives you very detailed practical advice about how to survive a trip to the hospital, how to pick a doctor. It's really amazing. To my knowledge, there's no book like this.
That's why when I, you know, before we went on the air, I was just telling you how much I want to be a proselytizer for this book. It is the book that we have needed. At the time of Obamacare, I can't tell you how many people urging me to write a book on healthcare. And I don't know anything about healthcare. I mean, I know some things, but I'm not an expert on it. And I really thought there is nothing in the world I'd want to do less than write a book on healthcare. But not only have you done it, but you've shown that a book on healthcare doesn't have to be deathly dull. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. The stuff that your co-author wrote is really tremendous because it's stuff I don't know the first thing about. Chapter 12 on surviving the hospital and what you're up against when you're in a hospital and all the regulatory red tape that the doctor has to comply with means that he's really more serving that than you because he's just forced to. There's so much in there. It's incredible. And then your stuff, you've dug up stuff on Obamacare that I haven't heard anybody talk about that's just brand new. I'm going to make it easy for people to get this book. TomWoods.com/prescription, okay, because you guys have a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell and this book, The Primal Prescription. TomWoods.com/prescription will take you right to the Amazon page for this book like a laser beam. You say that you're right. Chapter one is how we got here, the history of healthcare. We've covered that a little bit on the show. I want to, not quite as well as you have, but let's jump right into the FDA, and then we'll do Obamacare. Everybody's hankering for Obamacare. Let's hold on a minute. Because your coverage of the FDA here has some of what free market people might be familiar hearing, but it's not the same old, same old. You've got some more specific complaints about it. Let's start there.
Well, sure. And just to echo what you said there, that it really was it helped to have Doug here as the co-author, because for all of the general principles I would discuss as an economist, he could then supplement either in the main text or we'd have like little sidebars saying an ER doctor reports from the front lines. You know, I would talk about price controls and how the government in 2003 began slowing the rate of price increases it would allow on certain drugs in terms of its own purchasing and reimbursement formulas, thinking, oh, we're going to slow the growth of healthcare costs. And, you know, I could say, oh, price controls lead to shortages. And as an economist, I could say that and be very authoritative about it and draw a little supply and demand curve. But then Doug could say how, in practice, in the ER, he noticed that they started running out of certain things that they used all the time. They had to start mixing it themselves while there's a patient on the table. And so that's really what I mean, that he just supplements it and gives specific real-world examples to illustrate the broader economic principle. So you're right, Tom. As far as the FDA, we take – at first we start out and we do the standard economist or free market economist critique of the FDA that I think Milton Friedman probably popularized more than anybody else. And it's true insofar as it goes. And that is to say, look, the FDA is in charge of supposedly keeping – dangerous drugs off the shelves, approving safe drugs that, you know, are safe for people to use. And its incentives, there's a certain asymmetry there where if the FDA approves a drug and then people end up dying from side effects from it, the FDA is in trouble. Everyone can point to the FDA and say, that's your fault. You did that. Whereas if the FDA does not approve certain potentially useful drugs, holding it up through, you know, trials or just saying, oh no, you got to spend more money on testing and so forth, and people die because the FDA was in the way and prevented them from getting access to those drugs, well, no one blames the FDA. That's just, oh, well, you died because you had some kind of sickness, right? And so the idea is that the FDA, given those incentives, is going to err on the side of being real bureaucratic and putting more obstacles in the way of bringing drugs to market. And that sort of objection and critique of the FDA, like I say, was popularized by Milton Friedman. I think most free market economists today, when you ask them, you know, what does economics have to say about the FDA and its effect on the pharmaceutical industry and consumer welfare? That's probably what they would say. Oh, yeah, drugs are real expensive and hard to get because of the FDA. Just get out of the way and let us choose.
Yeah, that's frankly what I would say.
Right. And that's, like I said, that's true insofar as it goes. And we do have statistics in there extending what, you know, Friedman had shown how the cost of bringing a drug to market just skyrocketed and the delay between, you know, the initial testing and when it's actually on the shelves went way up. You know, after the thalidomide tragedy and so forth. And he's right with everything he said, and we just extended those statistics. But there's a whole other element involved, and that's what I haven't seen other free market economists discuss, and that is the FDA now, if it does approve a drug that really has dangerous side effects and really, in any rational sense, shouldn't be on the market, it's going to be very reluctant to then admit, oh yeah, we screwed up, let's yank that thing from the shelves. And also, there was the history is probably too long to get into in this venue, but because there were, I mean, just to give people an idea of how screwed up this system is, because there were backlogs, at some point they changed the rules so that the drug manufacturers could directly make, you know, pay money to the FDA so they could go hire the people, the staff, to then review the applications for the drugs. So the FDA people who were in charge of approving these new drugs were literally on the payroll of the manufacturers whose drugs were being evaluated. So there's certainly a conflict of interest there. And we just go through and document several tragic cases, Vioxx being the most notable, of where there was really a dangerous product on the shelves. People were raising red flags, screaming, internal whistleblowers and so forth. And the FDA just amazingly did not act. And the last point I'll make on this is we'd say, okay, so it's really that the FDA gives us the worst of both worlds, that they do hold up drugs that really ought to be available to people. And on the other hand, they go ahead and give the green light and give this false sense of security to drugs that really do have very dangerous side effects. And we're not just asking for the impossible. I mean, there was a great thing that Doug had showed me. There was this private ratings group called Worst Pills, Best Pills, just this private thing that, you know, they had doctors and so forth and would evaluate thing. And they correctly predicted all of the drugs that or the decisions that the FDA would later reverse. So the FDA would initially say, yes, something is safe for use, and then later change its mind. They actually, on second thought, no, don't use it. And this private group predicted in all the cases, in some cases, like years before the FDA reversed itself. Like these people said, no, this thing really shouldn't be available, and we predict that the FDA is going to eventually change its mind. And they didn't miss a single one. So that
shows.
All right.
Okay. What I want to tell people is I want you to rewind. Well, that's old fashioned language, but I want you to go back 30 seconds, 45 seconds in this podcast. And I want you to listen to what Bob just said a second time until it sinks in, because this is our argument. And here it is. in real life, it's not just a theoretical thing. Well, you know, privately, people could probably figure these things out. Not only probably, they did to a T. I mean, that's an amazing fact.
Yeah, and it just underscores, people say, wow, how could that – look, government officials are not magic, right? There's not something magical that happens just because the federal government creates an agency and gives it funding and all sorts of bureaucratic powers that all of a sudden they're better able to diagnose the properties of a certain substance on the human body. I mean, so again, you just have to ask yourself, what is the best way to organize a system? And we certainly know in science and in consumer products and the computer industry or whatever, the automobiles, that you want to have decentralized markets and competition. And so why wouldn't you expect the same pattern to hold here, that we want to say what system is going to make sure that people are going to render judgments, and if they end up being wrong many times in a row, then people stop listening to them and they go to some other authoritative source. Whereas with the FDA, it doesn't matter how bad – if they screw up, what's going to happen? They're going to get more funding, right? They're going to say, we're understaffed. Of course we screwed up on that. Well, look at the backlog we have here in applications and the pressure we're under. We need to hire more people, and Congress will give them more money, right? If there's a big scandal, the public is normally not going to say, oh, right, that just shows that – the federal government really is at fault here. No, they're going to say it's these greedy private pharmaceutical companies.
What interested me, one thing that interested me in this chapter, dealt with the subject of advertising and the FDA's regulations regarding advertising and the claims made for aspirin with regard to reducing the risk of heart attack in middle-aged men. They weren't allowing Bayer to say that there's research that seems to corroborate this. So all they could say on the package was, ask your doctor about new uses for Bayer. But what kind of an idiot has so little of a life? He's going to say, oh, by the way, what are some of the – what other reasons could I be taking Bayer? Let me read you one passage for the audience, one passage in here. This is from an author, Paul Rubin. He says the FDA's approval process is costly. This is an explanation why they didn't go through the approval process to get the FDA to sign off on the idea that aspirin could reduce the risk of heart attack. The FDA's approval process is costly, and it would cost some tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to obtain approval for aspirin as a heart attack preventative. Indeed, because the benefits of aspirin are so well documented, it might be impossible for ethical reasons to undertake such a study at all. Researchers would probably be unwilling to deny any patients the benefits of aspirin, as is required in such a study. You know, you have a control group, and then you have the one that gets it. The one study cited previously was terminated early because of the overwhelming evidence of the benefits of aspirin. And then let me read the conclusion that you and your co-author reach here. Let us reiterate the Kafkaesque absurdity and tragedy of the situation. The FDA would not allow aspirin manufacturers to tell their customers about the medical benefits of their product in preventing first heart attacks because these benefits had not been empirically validated in accordance with FDA protocol. Yet the reason the manufacturers couldn't provide such evidence was that the benefits were so obvious it would have been professionally unethical for researchers to conduct the relevant studies.
Right, and so that just is a great example, and so that's why they weren't allowed to advertise, right? You can't advertise for uses that, you know, for which the FDA is not, you know, giving you the green light to do so. And so that's what you would be, the doctor could talk about it. And so that's why Bayer ended up saying, okay, well, just ask your doctor, whereas they couldn't just put on the package all, those possible uses for aspirin. And then there's just silly stuff, too, that we talk about, which I learned doing research for the book, that you are, because there's all sorts of rules about the disclosures and things you have to give, and that's why people remember when you see on TV, you know, these ads for new drugs or new techniques or whatever, and then you have like this professional speed reader who comes on and lists all these horrible things that are going to happen to you or could happen to you if you take it, and so eventually you just end up tuning it out, right? So again, that's just another example of that if you make a mandate saying you have to list every possible side effect that could happen with this stuff, thinking, oh, that's going to make sure the public's well-informed. Well, no, the opposite happens. Now the people have no ability to distinguish between a legitimate danger versus, you know, something that's really minuscule and probably not going to happen, because anytime they hear a commercial for some sort of new drug,
right,
they have that thing that's a speed reader.
Right? Yeah, so and you tune just, it out. Yeah, you tune it out. All right, there's so much to cover here, Bob, and I want to make sure we do justice to you. I mean, there's the perverse economics of U.S. medicine is a very, very good chapter. I mean, you know what? I'm even going to have... I mean, look, you're a friend, and I'm allowed to say that, and I want your book to do well because it's a good book. You notice I haven't had you on for all your books, so I'm not... You know, that's... You know,
Wait, what are you trying to say there, Tom?
but tell me what... Because there's stuff in here that's... Well, let's go to Obamacare. Yeah, let's talk about Obamacare. We did an episode on Obamacare. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/516, and also at tomwoods.com/516. We'll have a link to your book, The Primal Prescription. What's the subtitle? I've got an electronic copy, and it's on chapter 4 right now.
Yeah, it's The Primal Prescription: Surviving the Sick Care Sinkhole. Right? So instead of health care, it's sick care.
Right. Okay, got it. So tomwoods.com/516. We'll link to that. Also, tomwoods.com/prescription will take you right there. Give me the basic standard boilerplate free market answer to Obamacare, but then what's your own unique take on this in this book that we haven't heard before?
Well, sure. So, when Obamacare was first a big thing, I was writing for various places like Mises.org and so forth, and I just walked through saying, this is how, you know, this is the inner logic of it, and you can't just, and so I think it's important for people to understand this, that they couldn't have just said, oh, every health insurance company can't turn away people. And anyone who applies for a policy, you got to grant it to them. That's universal coverage. They couldn't have just signed that into law and then been done with it, because think through the incentives of what would have happened. Where then they would have just said, oh, okay, so if you have a brain tumor, yeah, we'll give you a policy, and we're going to cap total payments at $20,000, and your premium is going to be $18,000 a month. See, we're in compliance with the law, right? So that would have been silly. And so if you start thinking through all the ways the private sector would have responded, you realize they couldn't have just done little piecemeal interventions. They really did have to mandate essential benefits. In other words, saying, no, the policies have to have all sorts of coverages of this quality, and you can't charge different people different amounts within, you know, certain parameters and so forth. And that's what's called community rating. And that, but then the other thing too is, you might say, well, what's this individual mandate? Why are they doing that? Well, because if they just put all those huge onerous restrictions on private health insurance companies, saying you can't turn people away, you can't charge them more, you can't limit coverage and give really junky policies, they just all would have gone out of business, right? They just would have closed shop and said, okay, well, why are we going to do this anymore? And so that's why they had to do the individual mandate, in order to give enough customers to them so that they could stay in business and charge premiums that were affordable, because now the healthy and the sick are all forced into the same pool. And then, you know, given the design of the legislation, there were obvious predictable effects that, look, if it says to an employer, you have to give health insurance to all of your full-time employees, well, guess what? Now all of a sudden you have a huge incentive to keep people part-time, right? So these things, you know, that the premiums are going to skyrocket, that there's going to be a huge effect on employment incentives, this is all standard stuff that other critics of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act have mentioned. And so we certainly cover all that, and that's the things I was in. But getting into the research for this book, I found a few things just to give you two examples, Tom. So one is the CBO. So they had to make estimates, right? The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, had to make fiscal estimates of revenues coming in because of this and how much expenditures. And so they had to make assumptions, and it was really shocking to unpack what they predicted was going to happen because of this. So one thing is, how many people did the CBO in the year 2016, when the individual mandate maxes out at its top level, how many people did they think were just going to pay the fine? And their estimate was it was going to be 3.9 million people paying a total of $4.2 billion in fines just in the year 2016. You might say, oh, these are like real rich people that for some reason just don't like health insurance. Not all of them. There were, in fact, 200,000 people that they thought were going to be below the poverty line, who in 2016 were just going to suck it up and pay the fine. And this isn't just people who owe the fine but aren't going to pay it. This is, they're predicting, you know, for revenue purposes. They're saying, no, we think this many people will actually pay it in 2016. All right. So if it's so affordable, if it's universal coverage, it's kind of scary that the government's own bean counters are projecting they're going to bring in $4.2 billion in 1 year from people who would rather just not have health insurance and pay the fine. And then to give you one other little factoid I dug up, part of this, if you remember the debate, was, you know, conservatives were saying, oh, it's going to be too expensive and, you know, big government. And then progressive defenders of the ACA, when the CBO came out and said, no, look, it's actually going to slightly reduce the deficit over its first 10 years. So this saves the government money and saves taxpayers money. Well, that was all crazy because it involves a huge $1 trillion in net new taxes. But what was interesting when you went in and looked at it, it wasn't just taxes on, quote, the rich, like the Medicare surtax and all that sort of thing, if people know the details. About $240 billion of the new revenue that the CBO said is going to come in from the Affordable Care Act came in from the following mechanism. So make sure people, you don't lose me here. Because of the way it was going to change the incentives facing employers, the CBO projected a lot of employers who originally paid for their employees' health coverage, and that was one of the, you know, the parts of your compensation package, one of the perks of the job, they were going to decide, you know, this is way too expensive. We're just going to pay a higher salary to our employees and let them go buy their own health insurance on the exchanges, right? And the CBO projected that so many people were going to have that happen. So many people were going to get kicked off their employer's plan and just given a higher salary to compensate. That guess what? Now that's a taxable benefit, right? Because if your employer was paying for your health insurance, you as an employee, you don't declare that on your taxes. But if they're paying you a higher salary, so you go buy your own insurance from the exchange, that is a taxable benefit. And so the CBO projected over the first 10 years, the IRS was going to take in $240 billion more from regular workers who now were just had a higher tax liability from that effect alone. So when people like Paul Krugman said, oh yeah, Obamacare pays for itself, you know, don't trust these critics, $240 billion of that paying for itself was workers getting kicked off their employer's health insurance, getting higher salaries in compensation, and then having to pay more taxes because now that's a taxable benefit. I don't remember President Obama getting up in front of the, you know, the American public and explaining that little element of it.
Oh, I get people saying, though, that, look, whatever complaints you may have about Obamacare, the fact is a huge number of people now have affordable care who couldn't have had it. It's true, yeah, there are some stories of premiums going up, but a lot of people have care that didn't have it before and, you know, wouldn't have had it if it hadn't been for Obamacare.
Well, sure. And obviously, when you have such an undertaking like this, if you don't care about the big picture and, you know, the abstract principles of property rights and whatever, I'm sure there are some people who are better off because of this than what would have happened under the status quo. But I think it's very naive, and Doug supplies a lot of anecdotes in this, and we try to give the statistics. It's very naive to think that just because now legislatively you've been guaranteed universal coverage and no one can turn you away, that that's the same thing as saying you're going to get quality medical care. Like the people, you know, the veterans apparently or theoretically were guaranteed coverage, right, for their service in the armed forces, and we know what happened with them. And by the same token, there's plenty of doctors who don't, just as a matter of principle or, you know, just because of the headaches, they don't take Medicaid patients. And so when we're documenting, they are progressive outlets have been running articles now for years, warming people up to the fact that you're going to have less doctor choice, right? And then they're trying to sell it to their people. Oh, well, this is how we're going to contain healthcare costs, and this is a good thing. You know, don't worry if you're, the cancer specialist is out of network or whatever. You didn't really need that guy. You know, you can get perfectly adequate care from these people over here. So it is true that, you know, someone say, oh, great, now no insurance company can turn me away. But if the plan you end up getting, and then in practice, are you really going to be able to see those specialists and what kind of care you're going to get, that is all going to deteriorate across the board. And so clearly, relative to a different possible reform that brought in more competition and sort of got the government out of the way, then relative to that benchmark, I think everybody's worse off.
Bob, let's take just a minute to thank our sponsors. Sometimes you just have to splurge. And here's a great example. Mises Canada is having a wonderful event in beautiful Toronto, November 6th to 7th, 2015, the 4th International Conference of Prices and Markets. It's going to feature some of your favorite Austrian economists, including Joe Salerno, Jeff Herbener, David Howden. These are all friends of mine, and you will learn a ton over the course of the weekend. You'll hear papers on the cutting edge of research in the Austrian school, plus a special Austrians in Finance roundtable on the markets. And I'm sweetening the deal. You can take 33% off the registration fee when you check it out at tomwoods.com/Canada. I bet you weren't planning on going to Canada, but think about it. It's going to be eating away at you. Shouldn't I be at this event? Wouldn't it be a great time? Wouldn't I meet a lot of interesting people? Yes, yes, and yes. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Canada. Here's some good advice. Be an informed consumer and don't get scammed. There's been a surge in physical demand for gold, and the conditions are ripe for scammers. Oh, buy collectible coins. Buy coins with numismatic value. Get a leveraged gold account. Get this price protection plan. They're scams, and Peter Schiff's free report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off, will help you avoid them. Schiff Gold, which is where I get all my own precious metals, is doing the public a tremendous service with this report. See, the trouble is the precious metals industry is an extremely low-margin one. So some dealers just can't resist the temptation to try to make it into a high-margin one at your expense. That's why you won't want to make any moves with regard to gold without checking out Peter Schiff's free report, which you can read at tomwoods.com/scams. There's so much to talk about here. I think we have to at least pause for a minute and have you explain what the word primal refers to in the title.
Well, sure. So again, it was Mark Sisson who originally approached me about this book. And so, you know, he's of course famous for the primal nutrition. And there, the idea is that what's wrong with the modern American, you know, why is it that, geez, we're so well educated in terms of diet and nutrition, and people can really try to do the right thing and listen to the experts. And yet it doesn't seem to be working. You know, they're obese and so forth and out of shape and just fatigued all the time. What's going on? And so his recommendation and his diagnosis was that the modern system of the experts and the FDA and the food pyramid and all that stuff was really diametrically opposed to what was, in a sense, genetically in your hardwired into you. And then just returning to those natural roots, that was the way to achieve just a turnaround in your life, take charge of your own health. And so part of what we're doing in this book, and my co-author Doug McGuff is a big proponent of the primal lifestyle, and there's later parts in the book where he talks about that in depth, citing scientific studies and so forth. And that's part of it, that we're trying to say, look, we don't want to be all doom and gloom. The system itself is really on a bad trajectory, and the ACA just made it worse, but here's how you can take charge. So people who are familiar with Sisson's work, Primal Blueprint and so forth, this book is going to be right up their alley. It's just kind of enlarging the picture and saying, instead of just talking about what do you buy at the store and how do you cook meals and what kind of exercise should you be doing, it's also going to say, how do you pick a doctor? What do you do if you do have to go into the hospital? What sort of techniques should you use? So it's coming from people with that sort of mentality.
I want to point out that I first interviewed Mark Sisson years ago when I hosted the Peter Schiff Show. And that interview, more than anyone I've ever done, it just got more feedback. I got people coming up to me years later saying that interview changed my life completely because I adopted the Primal Blueprint and I lost a tremendous amount of weight and I have more energy than ever. It's the kind of claims that sound like it's a scam. But since I've done it myself, I can tell you that it actually does work. And I'm going to put also at tomwoods.com/516 a link that'll have my original interview with him. We did an episode of the Tom Woods Show with Mark Sisson. But also, I made a YouTube on how I took off some weight. And I just did it because people have been asking. And the next morning, I just flipped on the video, and it had gotten 25,000 views while I was sleeping because people are always searching for videos like this. So it really, really does, it does honest and truly work.
And if I could just say, Tom,
yeah, sure.
What's interesting about it, you say you don't interview me for every book, but by the same token, when I talked to normal people and told them what I was working on, this book, way more than anything else, like, you know, normal people who aren't really losing sleep at night because they're trying to grapple with Austrian capital theory, normal people were like, oh, tell me when that book comes out. I want to see that. And, you know, so this really does resonate with the average person. Because your health, I mean, I guess people care about their finances and they want to know, what do I do with my money? But beyond that, and they want to, you know, relationships, they want to know, how do I get that special someone to take a notice of me? And then the other big thing is their personal health. And what do I do? And how do I stay healthy? And how do I eat? And that's, of course, what's so interesting is, as Austrian economists, you know, we understand that, oh my gosh, the stuff the experts are saying, the stuff coming from the Federal Reserve and all the so-called knowledgeable people in the Ivy League, it's not just that that's a little bit off, it's diametrically opposed. They're causing, or at least exacerbating, the very problems they think they're solving. And so what's eerie is the same pattern is in medicine. And I've talked to people who were not libertarian at all. They were just were like nutritionists. The sister of one of my childhood friends, she went into nutrition and was studying that stuff and then ended up being converted. You know, she went in to debunk it because some of her clients were into this stuff, the paleo diet and so forth. And she went in to debunk it and then was converted while she did the research. And then I explained to her, okay, you see how the FDA is doing the exact wrong thing? Well, that's where I'm coming from. I've studied monetary theory and banking, and that's what the government's doing over here. So people start to see, yeah, it is really the people in Washington, when they get involved in something, they give horrible advice, and then they end up picking these insiders and these big corporations that also do not have the general welfare at heart.
I want to, before we wrap up here, I want to say something about one of the chapters that probably I would assume Dr. McGough was primarily responsible for, and I will have him on the show in the coming weeks, and we'll talk about different aspects of the book. But still, just to give people a bit of a preview, you've got in Chapter 13, Medical Screening and Elective Procedures, Worth the Risk. And there's a discussion here. A lot of people, I think, by now know the stuff about mammograms, but I'm not sure enough of them know. There's a friend from high school, or at least an acquaintance from high school, I see on Facebook always telling people, go in and get your mammogram every, extremely frequently. So that, it's very well intended. We want to try and see if you have cancer as early as we possibly can. What could possibly be a problem with that?
Well, there's a few things. And so there have been cutting edge studies, and we summarize the research in there, that the actual consensus among people who look at that is that, these things should not be blanket rules for people to follow. If you're in a certain risk group, like if your mom had breast cancer or so, that's a different subject. But this idea that this popular notion that, let's have celebrities get on TV and urge people to go get tested. And the same thing with men too, as well, with the test for them. And this idea that, no, there are actual harms, and you can go through and we just use economics. So the point is not to, we don't end up concluding and saying, therefore, if you're reading this book right now, you should not get a mammogram or you shouldn't do that. That's not where we try to give people a framework for evaluating the marginal costs and benefits. And we have a neat little discussion there that we borrowed from John Goodman, who is the other free market healthcare economist that we have on our team here, just walking through and showing the change in the frequency, right? So, okay, so you say everyone should get a mammogram. Well, how often? Should they get it every 6 years, every 2 years, every week? And so if you start changing the frequency, you realize at some point it would cost more than it was worth. And so there's that element as well in terms of how much lifetimes, how much do you gain by catching the thing earlier? But beyond all that, there's also the psychological problems, right? And so we give the specific numbers in terms of mammograms, but it's the reason the testing they use there, people like it so much, is that if you really do have breast cancer, it's the screening is probably not going to miss it. I mean, it's possible it'll miss it, but it's very unlikely, right? So if you actually do have it, the screening is good that it'll catch it. But on the other hand, there's a lot of false positives, right? So women who actually are fine will go in for initial screening, doing the right thing, and then they'll say, oh, wait, you know what? You better come back. We got to look at this some more. And so just the anxiety from that interim period, there are studies that track women like that longitudinally to see, and there's objective evidence that they really still are, some of them suffering anxiety from that for far into the future after that initial false positive. Right, so you have to take into account things like that. So a blanket rule that, do the right thing, everyone go get tested. No, there's fallout from that. As with anything in economics, there's trade-offs, costs and benefits. And so we just try to give people a framework for rationally thinking through how should you approach your own treatment, and even especially when it comes to preventive and elective measures.
Part four of the book has two chapters, Rolling Back Big Government and Big Pharma, and Living Healthy and Free. And part four is called Freedom is the Answer. Leave us with a word on this.
Well, sure. And here, we mostly did this just for logical completeness, right? So the book was not supposed to be some sort of manifesto, call to action, and have everyone go march on Washington and tear down the FDA. That's not at all what it was supposed to be. It was to give people a diagnosis of this is where the system's going. You want to extricate yourself, insulate yourself as soon as you can. But as far as just leaving people with something to say, well, are we just doomed? Is the whole system, on a trajectory that nothing could be done? No, we explain clearly there's all sorts of things that you could do. So, for example, you could make the FDA just a purely voluntary thing, right? So if you try to blend both worlds, if people say, no, we really need those experts in Washington telling us what's safer. And I say, okay, they can still issue their own judgments on things, but they can't forcibly prevent voluntary clients from going and seeing people that they think are good healthcare providers, right? They should just be able to offer their own opinion as opposed to getting in the way of people. Getting rid of all sorts of subsidies, you know, the food, agriculture subsidies to farmers in terms of understanding why is it that the FDA seems to be so big on pushing wheat and, you know, carbohydrates that what people follow Marxists and know that that's not really optimal. And you can understand, well, there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes in terms of farm subsidies. And so we talk about that a little bit. And just in general, the idea is you want to extricate yourself from the system where possible. Don't rely on third-party payment. We give tips on how do you find a doctor who just takes cash payments. So part of the theme here is you want to deal with a doctor or healthcare professionals who treat it like it's a business transaction where you're the customer and they're trying to keep you happy and they're in a sort of serving a fiduciary role while you're paying them. Whereas the system as it's evolved, there's these third-party payers, health insurance companies and the government, that they're the ones paying. And so, of course, they're the ones calling the shots and you're sort of just this nuisance who you're trying to get as much medical care as possible because it's not costing you anything on the margin. And so that system doesn't work. The way it works is you find doctors who think like this and you sort of secede from the system, if you will, and just do transactions that way.
Well, I'll also link to my talk with Dr. Josh Umber, which is one of the most popular episodes I've ever done, who has a basically like a monthly fee for service kind of system. You pay X dollars a month and he just gives you all these different services, but he doesn't use third party payers. He's got no connection with the government and he's had a great deal of success with it. Well, I hope you have a great deal of success with the Primal Prescription because it is so well done and it fills a gap in our knowledge and in the whole libertarian argument. So it's the Primal Prescription, Surviving the Sick Care Sinkhole. I'll have a bunch of related items at tomwoods.com/516, including the book itself. And I've already created a convenient shortcut, of course, with my affiliate link baked in there to help out the show. tomwoods.com/prescription will take you immediately to the Amazon page. And I know you're thinking to yourself, Woods, you're always giving me a lot of great books that I should read. And I know, it's true. There are a lot of great books out there. But to heck with all those. You know, set a match to them. Read The Primal Prescription by Doug McGuff and Bob Murphy. Bob, best of luck. We'll talk to you soon for Contra Krugman.
Thanks so much, Tom. Good job on your show.
All right. Well, you now know about the book to read on healthcare. And by the way, it even sounds boring talking about a book on healthcare. Wait till you see this one. This one reads like a novel. So it's not just that it gives our perspective. It takes this information and makes it thrilling and exciting. You're going to learn so much that you will not read anywhere else. It is such a tremendous presentation. I can't say enough about it. I am so excited for Bob. It's such a wonderful achievement. tomwoods.com/prescription will take you right to the Amazon page with it. And we've got some other resources as well on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/516. Tomorrow on the show, a husband and wife couple join us, both of whom were conscientious objectors in the military just over the past several years. And they're going to tell us their story about how they came to that conclusion, what the process was like. This is definitely one you're not going to want to miss. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.